Okay.
Okay, I'm
that's
going
recording.
To.
Wait, 1 second.
All right.
All right. Let's see. Okay. Okay, good. I think we're ready to go.
Okay, this is April 25th, 2008, and we are at 3400 South Cedar in Lansing, which is the South Precinct. Today we have Richard Fox, John Asaf, and J. Craig Gleason here for Captain Fox's interview. Captain, what drew you to become a member of the Lansing Police Department back in your day?
Shortly after high school, I joined the military, and I was a military policeman. Prior to that, I had no thoughts of what I was going to be when I was an adult, certainly not be a police officer. I guess I wanted to be a sports writer. However, having been in the military police for 4 years, I decided that's what I want to be, a civilian police officer. So shortly after my discharge, I applied for the Lansing Police Department, and shortly after that, I was accepted and hired.
Great. What can you recall of your training as becoming an officer? Obviously, in today's line, you know, there's many weeks of training. What was your training like in your first days when you became a police officer?
There were seven of us hired on at the same time, and the seven of us attended what was referred to then as the Lansing Police Training School. It was a three-week school. We spent the first 2 weeks in a classroom in the number one fire station, in which we learned how to do reports, criminal reports, special reports. We learned the state law, the city ordinances, even how to write a traffic ticket and a parking ticket, and et cetera. Those were 2 weeks. The third week, we went to the firing range, where on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday morning, we fired the 38 revolver and the shotgun and the rifle, and went through gas training, where they put us in gas masks and had gas. And then at noon on Thursday, we completed our training, went down to the police station, where we were all sworn in as police officers, issued our uniforms, our credentials, and we had Friday and Saturday off, and on Sunday, which I believe was May 1st of 1953, we went to work, all seven of us on the night shift.
Can you remember any specific stories of those first few days as far as on the night shift or shortly thereafter?
Well, I remember going to work that very first night, and not counting the seven recruits, there were 10 officers, there were 30 officers lined up at roll call. 20 officers at roll call. 10 were assigned foot beats, and 10 were assigned police cars, two-man cars. They were all two-man cars in those days because they felt instead of sending two cars to a scene of whatever, they would send one car with two officers in it. So we had five patrol cars policing the city of Lansing and 10 foot beats, and that was kind of shocking to me. Hadn't been an experienced police officer, but 4 years in the military police give me a little insight, during which time we worked, I worked town patrol in Montgomery, Alabama, so I had an idea of what city police did, but here we had 10 foot beats and five police cars when I first started.
Can you recall city limits back in those days? It was a little bit smaller than today, obviously, but do you recall any of that, sir?
Yeah, it was smaller. The north side, I believe, was Jackson Street. The south side was Jolly Road on the east side of Washington Avenue and Holmes Road on the west side. The north the west side, I don't remember just where the city limits were, but I know when you were on the on what then was Logan Street, ended at Grand River Avenue, and DeWitt Road continued north from Grand River Avenue, and that was the city limits, because I was living, had a room in a rooming house on DeWitt Road just off of Grand River, and I was on the west side of the street, which was outside the city limits. Well, I went through, I had no idea that I was violating a city ordinance by living across the street. Well, after, I got away with it for about 6 weeks. And one day, the chief secretary, at that time it was a male secretary, his name was Duncan. Duncan called me in and says, "Fox, I just learned that you are living outside the city. You have 10 days to move into the city or you will be terminated." And I says, "Hey, Mr. Duncan, I'm right across the street from the city. The middle of the street's the city limits." He says, "It doesn't make any difference. You're required to live in the city." So fortunately, they let me break my lease, and I moved out and moved into the city.
Okay, I take it at that point in time, perhaps you were not married then. So
No, I was single.
Okay, and then, because I just wanted to get to a question, how your family felt, you becoming a police officer, and maybe that would include your lovely bride.
Well, of course, at the time I didn't have a bride. I never had even a special girlfriend in that time. I do remember my mother and dad and brothers and sisters all were very proud the fact that I came out of the military police and onto the Lansing police. But no, I had no wife, no family.
Okay,
all right. How about some of your first arrests that you made? Can you remember any of those?
You know, one of the earlier arrests I made, I was walking a beat downtown, and there was a jewelry store on Michigan Avenue, just east of Grand, on the south side of Michigan. And I was... it was raining, so I stood inside a doorway on the corner of a store on the corner of Michigan and Grand, and I saw two guys step into the doorway of that jewelry store. I thought to myself, there was a bus stop there, and although it was late at night, the buses still ran between Lansing and East Lansing until late at night. One reason being, East Lansing was dry. No alcohol could be served in those days, and so students by the hundreds, maybe thousands, would come downtown Lansing. Well, I thought these two guys were just stepping into the entrance of that jewelry store to get out of the rain. But bam, I heard glass breaking. So I went across the street. Back in those days, we didn't carry radios we didn't have walkie-talkies. There was a call box, but the nearest call box was up on Michigan and Washington, and I was at Michigan and Grand. So I went in to the entranceway of the jewelry store, and sure as heck, these two guys had broken into the jewelry store. So I arrested them both. One of the things that I later was criticized for by the detectives is I left the scene unprotected, because I went in, I caught these two guys, I told them to put their hands up, and I had my flashlight in my left hand and my revolver in my right hand. And I marched those two guys from that jewelry store into the police station. Walked, and they had their hands up. And I remember, I was scared. I said to myself, "I wonder what's going to happen if these guys try to jump me or if they run." So I told them, I says, "Guys, I'm probably as scared as you are. So if you decide you're going to try to jump me or you decide you're going to run, I'm going to shoot you both dead." And when I said that, their hands went up just a little bit higher. And I walked them into the police station with their hands up, and I with my gun on, and Captain Rainwater was sitting behind the desk when I walked in, and I thought he was going to have the big one as I walked in there with two guys with their hands up. And although the detectives, they were Seagraves and O'Toole, were critical of me for leaving that scene unprotected. They said, I remember O'Toole said, you got a whistle? Why, there are other beat officers. Why didn't you just blow your whistle or try to get attention? Why didn't you use a phone in the jewelry store? However, Captain Rainwater wasn't critical of it. He gave me back in those days, they were pretty free with citations. That guy must have four or five citations, and that was the first citation I got, and probably my first felony arrest. In fact, it was my first felony arrest.
Excellent.
Oh, my first night on the police department, I'm not going to identify the guy who I was working with, but he was an older, veteran police officer. And my first night, we go into this restaurant to have a cup of coffee, and we sat up at the counter, and the waitress said, well, I know you're going to have your usual black coffee. And he says, what do you want? Says, I'll have a glass of milk. And as she went back to get the coffee and milk, my partner said to me, police officers don't drink milk, they drink coffee, and they drink it black. So I yelled to the waitress, change that milk to a cup of black coffee, and I don't think I've had a glass of milk since.
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh. Did you attend colleges or special training during your career?
I went to community college and got an associate degree in law enforcement from community college. And I'm also very fortunate to have attended the FBI Academy, the Law Enforcement National Academy, the FBI.
Great. Okay.
You were... maybe jumping the gun a little bit, but you were a detective for quite a while, is that correct?
11 years. I was 42 years in the police department, and I enjoyed every day from my first day to my last day. But while I enjoyed it and look forward to the highlight of my 42 years were the 11 years I spent as a detective. Greatest job I've ever had.
Oh, one of your partners, I believe, was Tom Munshaw, is that correct?
Yes.
How long were you partnering up with him?
I had a lot of partners, and I don't want to... I enjoyed them all, but Tom was one of the best. And I was assigned to Tom in September of 1968, and we were partners until March of 1972. And... back in those days, maybe you guys remember this, but they don't do it anymore. Detectives always work partners. They didn't work alone. They worked partners. I had a lot of great partners. Spike Edey, Horace Montgomery, Joe Norton, Tom Munshaw. But I enjoyed them all, but Munshaw was special.
What kind of cases that might have stood out did you handle when you were in the Detective Bureau?
Well, again, in those days, there were no squads, special squads. The detectives, 20 of us, 20-some, were all generalists. You did not get, and I had a lot of homicides, robberies. I really got a lot of big cases. I know I used to do an awful lot of extraditions. Someplace in my notes here I have how many extraditions I did, and it seems like I was always going. New York City, Los Angeles, Dallas. Went to Los Angeles 3 times. And I remember one time somebody said something to me about all those extraditions I made. And I said to him, you don't go to Los Angeles to get a guy wanted for assault and battery. I mean, they are murderers, robbers, rapists. Mm-hmm. I was very pleased. I had Captain Groke as my detective commander for the first couple years, And then they did away with captain, they reorganized, and I had a, well, there was still a captain over the detectives, but they also placed a lieutenant. And I had Lieutenant Griffin, a wonderful man. And Griffin was the lieutenant in charge of the detectives, and Griffin took a liking to me, and he treated me right. For an example, back in those days, there was a lot of riots. The West Side racial riots, the MSU student riots, and the detectives, for the most part, would all have to get on uniforms and join the troops at the riots. I never did. Griffin would always hold back several detectives to work the detective cases, and I was one of those that he always held back to continue to work the investigations.
Being a detective then, and we were kind of chatting about that earlier, how about some comments concerning some of the Supreme Court decisions, Escobedo, Miranda, things of that nature, and how that impacted your investigatory work?
When I was first went to the detectives in 1963, we did have Escobedo, but he was not a problem. The only thing that I recall he required, you could not make, when you're interviewing a suspect, you could not make him any promises. But I take great pride in being a very good interrogator. And gentlemen, I got an awful lot of confessions. There'd be a crime, you develop a suspect through investigation, bring the suspect in and interrogate him, and I'd get a confession. Most of the time, I would get a confession. And then Miranda came along. Boy, confessions almost stopped. Well, now you're interviewing a suspect and you got to tell him, you better not talk to me, because if you do, I'm going to use it against you. And if you want a lawyer and you can't afford one, I'll get you one. It changed investigative procedures. Some people think it was for the best, because now you had to build a case without a confession. Well, even in those days, you know, you had to have more than a confession. You couldn't charge a man on just a confession, but it sure did help, and I got a lot of them before Miranda and few of them after Miranda.
You were also, I think, involved in a lot of sporting events kind of things, as it's kind of associated with the police department. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, when the FOP first got organized, they had they sponsored athletic teams, and I was the athletic director for the FOP. I also did youth coaching. I coached FOP youth teams. In fact, back in the, I'm going to guess about 1970, the Civitans of Lansing put on a Officer of the Year. Lansing Police Officer of the Year was honored at a dinner at the Civic Center. And despite what I thought was a lot of good police work that I did, the only time that I ever made Officer of the Year was when Lieutenant Griffin recommended me with a beautiful letter, I've got it at home, in which he told the Civitans how much good I do with the youth as a youth athletic coach. And they honored me as the Police Officer of the Year, not for solving crimes and making arrests, but for being a coach.
I'm sure that still had a good positive impact on the community, though.
I think I would like to interject right now about one of my favorite stories about when I was a detective and overtime. There was no union, and we worked overtime. You also did not have to, you got only straight time for it. But you did not have to get, like now, I guess if an officer wants to work overtime, his supervisor has to authorize it before he can do it. Back in those days, if we were on a case and we wanted to work overtime, we just worked overtime. You'd fill out an overtime form, the complaint number, the date, the hours worked, and a little summary of what you did. You'd turn that into the captain, and he would record your overtime. And he kept it in a overtime book. He had a log. And I probably had, in fact, I know I had 40 hours on the books. And one morning, he had a big office. There's probably 20 detectives, and you could all fit in his office, and he sat behind the chair, and he called everybody in. We were some of us sitting down, some of us standing up. He was having a detective meeting, and so we went to the meeting, 8 o'clock in the morning. We all reported for work and all told the captain's having a meeting. So we go in his office, and he opens up the drawer to his desk, and he gets out the overtime book. And he looks around the room and says, "Gentlemen, we have been accumulating entirely too much overtime, and we're going to do something about it." And I thought, great, I'm going to get it. Because even though you had 40 hours coming, it was tough to get it. They wouldn't give you time and a half overtime or pay. You got straight time, hour for hour work. And even then, it was difficult to get some time off. But I thought, he's going to make us take some time off. Well, he picked that overtime book up. He had a wastebasket next to his desk, and he slammed it into the wastebasket, opened up his drawer, came out with a brand new, same kind of a book. "As of today, we start over." Man, I'd like to cry. I know there was a restaurant at that time in North Washington called the Eagle Restaurant. And I went there after that meeting with myself, Lieutenant Edie, Detective Wilkins, and Lieutenant Griffin. Back in those days, lieutenants were street detectives. We went in there to have our morning coffee, and I remember saying, "Gentlemen, I had 40 hours in that book." And I remember Griffin saying, "I had over 100. We all like to cry, but we lost it. And related to that, I was telling a friend of mine one time, during this same time era where you worked overtime, you didn't get paid for it, you did not get time and a half compensatory time, you got straight time. And he said to me, "Dick, they can't do that. It's against the law. The law requires that you be paid time and a half or given comp time at time and a half." He said, "You call the Labor Department and they'll verify it." So, boy, I went back into my office and I picked up the phone and called the Labor Department. And I asked him if that was a law, that I was a Lansing police detective and we worked a lot of overtime and we did not get time and a half pay. We did not get time and a half comp time. We got straight time for hours worked. And this guy from the Labor Department says, "Absolutely they can't do that. That's against the law. Yeah, they can't do that." He says, "You know where we're located? We're down here at the Leonard Building on North Washington Avenue. Come on down here and file a complaint, and we'll stop that. They can't do that." I remember I was on the phone. I said, "You mean you won't take an anonymous complaint?" "Absolutely not. We don't." I said, "Did I give you my name? Did I identify myself?" And he says, "No, you're just a detective in the Lansing Police Department, but you don't know who." "No." "Good." Click. I'd have gone down there and filed that complaint, gentlemen, and I tell you something. The city might have to do something about their time, their comp time and their overtime policy, but Dick Fox wouldn't have been a detective. I'd have been walking a beaten Frandor.
Oh, yes. Well, sir, go ahead.
I was going to ask you about some of the... some of the characters that you know or you knew and stories about them, and you can name them or you don't have to name them, but some of the people that were senior to you, do you have any stories about those kind of people? Not necessarily when you were a detective, but back in the early days.
Well, I know this, guys. There used to be, and I'm not going to, it's best that I don't get into... individual stories now, but there used to be, and I never did it, but I witnessed a lot of it, street justice. And I guess that's pretty well understood what street justice is. No, I can only say that I had nothing but the greatest admiration for all of the senior officers. The command officers were all great. They were good to me, and so I guess that's why I had no problem with any of them. I do want to tell one story I had about in those days. I mentioned earlier you had to live in the city. Well, you not only had to live in the city, you could not leave the city without signing out. There was a sign-out book on the sergeant's desk, and if you're going to leave the city, you better sign out. Well, one Sunday morning, I was dating this girl. Now, it turned out later to be my wife, but at that time we were dating. And we went to Mass at St. Mary's. I was supposed to work the afternoon shift at 2 o'clock. And it was a nice day. And we decided to take a drive in the country. And we were on driving on Francis Road at Price Road. And Francis was a through road. And a guy ran the stop sign at Price Road, and we had a collision. And the car was, you know, I was unable to drive it. I had to call a wrecker. And I knew right then, as I looked at my watch, that I was going to be late for work. So while we're waiting for the sheriff's department to come and police the accident and waiting for the wrecker, I went to a farmhouse right there on just short distance from where the accident was. I asked if I could use the phone somehow or another. So they had seen the accident and had called the police. They told me that. I said, well, I want to call my lieutenant. I'm a police officer. Well, I knew the lieutenant wasn't there yet. He wouldn't get in until about, you know, 1:30 for a 2 o'clock shift. But I called a friend of mine, and I told him that I had left the city without signing out, and I was concerned and wondered if he would go in and sign me out. Just sign me out for a country drive, any place. In fact, I think I told him where to sign me out for, but I don't recall. And he wouldn't do it. And he got mad at me for asking him. I remember he saying, Dick, you're going down the river, and you ain't going to take me with you. It was that big a deal to sign out. Well, I waited until, I think I was at the body shop by the time it got to be 1:30, but I knew I was going to be late. And I knew by this time the lieutenant would be there, because they got there a little early to get the paperwork ready and put the troops to work. And I called the police department and I asked to speak to Lieutenant Peterson. And Lieutenant Peterson was so nice. He said, Dick, I understand. You know, you got to do what you got to do. When you get around to come on in to work, come on in. And he says, I'll tell you right now, you're walking the downtown Four Corner Beat when you get in. So, but when you get in, you're in. Don't worry about it. Well, I was several hours late when I came in and reported into the desk and let him know I was here. And he called me into the inner office, says, Dick, you didn't sign out of the city. He had checked the sign-off book and I wasn't in it, and he told me, I'm going to have to write you up. In those days, they called it put you on report. And in 42 years in the police department, that was the only time that I was written up or put on report for leaving the city without signing out. Now, the following day, the chief's office was right adjacent to the assistant chief's office. And when you're in the assistant chief's office, then call the inspector, you could hear a conversation in the chief's office. The walls were thin. And a friend of mine, Officer John Pizzo, had an appointment with the assistant chief, and he was in his office, and Paul Taylor was the chief of police, and Lieutenant Peterson went into Chief Taylor's office, and Pizzo overheard this conversation. And Peterson said to the chief, Taylor, did you get my report where I had to write Fox up for not leaving, signing out when he left the city? And the chief said, yes, I did, and you recommended in your report that he be suspended for one day. And Peterson says, yes, I think that's fair to suspend him for one day. And Pizzo told me that the chief looked at Peterson and he says, there ain't no way I'm going to suspend Fox for leaving the city without signing out. Fox is a fine young police officer, and I don't want to do anything that might discourage him. We're not going to do any disciplinary action except the report that will be in his file. As a matter of fact, Pizzo told me, Chief Taylor said to Lieutenant Peterson, I do not like that rule. I never have liked it, and at the next Board of Police Commissioners meeting, I'm going to attempt to get it changed. Well, several weeks later, there was a Board of Police Commissioners meeting, and coming out of that meeting, they had changed the rule. You no longer had to sign out when you left the city. And most of the guys in the police department all knew that I had left the city. They knew what had happened. They knew I'd gotten written up for it. And for quite some time after that, some of my buddies referred to that rule as they've changed the rule, and they referred to it as the Fox rule. But that's how that was changed. But it's hard to believe you not only had to live in the city. I know this, that after that occurrence, for about the 3 or 4 weeks that there was still, that you still had to sign out before it was changed, every day when I got off duty, I would sign out. I'd pick a fictitious name, where I was going, because you had a destination on there. And I would go all over. And if I had a weekend, if I had several days off, hell, I went to China one time. I remember signing out for China, because I was a little bit bitter about it that I'd gotten rid up for, you know, just on a whim deciding to take a drive in the country. But anyway.
Speaking of that kind of thing, when I started on the police department, there was a time clock. I think that's what you call it, where you had to punch a time clock. Now, there probably wasn't originally a time clock when you started. What did people feel about that when the police department established that time clock?
You know, John, I remember that time clock. I was a detective at the time. But I don't remember a whole lot of, you know, the usual complaining, but I don't remember any big deal over it. I don't really know why they started it or why they stopped it. It didn't last very long.
Right.
But it was in existence for a while, where you punched in and punched out. And I don't know the reason for it.
Well, I remember that there was some resentment towards that thing. But again, you're right. I don't know when it started, but it didn't last long after I was there.
Yeah, it wasn't there when I first started, and yet, you're right, it was there for a short time. I don't know if it lasted a year or 2 years, but yeah, I know the troops didn't care for it, because it was just like a slap in their face kind of a thing, the way I remember it anyway. But this is your story, I'm sorry. But.
I would like to tell a couple of other stories that I think are of interest to when I was a detective. There was a break-in at Robinson Supermarket. Some guns were stolen. I was working with Joe Norton. Norton and I were assigned the case, and a young man came into the police department, wanted to talk to the detectives assigned to the Robinson case. So we took him in, and he told us who had broke into it. There were four of them. They were just driving around the city, drinking, late teenagers, early 20s. And this young man told us that they pulled into Robinson's, decided they're going to break in and steal some guns. Robinson's was on South Cedar Street. I believe it's now a Salvation Army store. And anyway, he said, I had nothing to do with it. I did not want to break in. And they said, okay, if you don't want to do it, you stay in the car. And the other three broke in and stole some guns. And tonight, they're going to rob the Quality Dairy on the corner of Pleasant Grove and Holmes Road. They're going to use the guns, and they're going to rob them. And he says they're going to go there from a house that I don't know the name of the street, but I know where the house is. And if you want, I'll take you over there and show you. He says, what time are they going to do this? Well, they're going to meet. This was in March. And the reason I remember it was March, it was the week of Good Friday and Easter Sunday, the week prior to that this happened. So this young man, we agreed to meet him back at 8 o'clock that night at the police station. He would not tell us his name. He wouldn't even tell us where he lived. So to this day, I don't know who that guy was. Because he was not going to be a witness. He just wanted us to know that they had, who broke in, who had the guns in there. So we alerted a patrol sergeant, and he had several officers parked behind what was then Terra Nova's grocery store. They were there waiting because they knew eventually a Quality Dairy is going to be robbed that night, and we were going to catch them. We were going to wait till they came out of the Quality Dairy, and we were going to call the three police officers over, and Joe and I, and we were going to arrest them in the parking lot. We were going to not only get them for the breaking and entering of Robinson's department store, we were going to get them for armed robbery of the Quality Dairy. Now we're sitting in the, we do not know what street we're on. The kid took us over to where Deja Vu is now. At that time it was an A&P grocery store. And we were sitting in the parking lot, and we could look down that street right across the parking lot, and I'm behind the driver's wheel. The kid's in the back seat, or the informant. Joe Norton is sitting in the passenger seat, and he's got the glasses on the house where the gun, the people are, and we got the police radio on, and the radio barked out, sending an ambulance, the district car, and detectives en route to 5101 Bogart. Just had a report of a shooting. And I says to Norton, as he looks at the house with his glasses, says, "Joe, where the hell is 5101 Bogart?" And Joe responded, "I got no idea." About that time, there come an ambulance, there came the police car, there came the detectives. They all pulled into that house that we had under surveillance. And Joe Norton, just as calm as clue, he put the glass in. "Dick, I know where 5101 Bogart is." Well, prior to going to pull the robbery, one of the three guys who were going to do it, they also had their girlfriends at this house, played Russian roulette. Shot himself right in the forehead. Dead. And prior to that call going out, I had seen a guy go out the back door and go and was carrying a paper bag. And he walked out into a garden. It was not a garden in March, but it had been. There were still some corn stalks. So Joe and I went over the house. Dietering and Hollinsworth were the detectives, and they went, "What the heck are you guys doing here?" "Oh, we just happened to be in the area. You know, we were off duty. We were on overtime, comp time." But nobody knew that we were there except the sergeant and the two officers who were in on this. Well, so they took everybody in the house. Of course, the ambulance took the dead man away, and they took everybody else in the house downtown to interview him. And turned out, they didn't have a murder. I don't think so. They came to the conclusion it was definitely a Russian roulette, but I've never been convinced it was. So Joe and I go out into this garden where I'd seen that paper bag and found that paper bag and had guns in it. Wow, we knew they were coming back for it. So Joe and I laid there in March, possibly April, might have been April, but it was cold. And we laid there on the ground of that garden waiting for somebody to come and get those guns. And we laid there until all night, until daybreak. And nobody ever came, so we took the guns in, tagged them in as evidence, and to this day, the Robinson supermarket is still an unsolved case. And whether it was a murder or a Russian roulette, we'll never know that either. And I still don't know who that informant was who when this happened, and we said we're going to go over there, he says, "I'm leaving, goodbye." Don't know, I have any clue who that kid, that young man was.
You said you had another.
I got another story that I think was interesting, and I'll identify this man. His name was Stardevant. What was his first name? Ron Stardevant. Maybe you guys remember Stardevant. He was a notorious outlaw, and had a knack for breaking out of jails. And he, his most recent, he was in jail in one of the southern counties, I'm not sure just which one, and he went to court, and it was on the first room, the courthouse was on the first room, and it was summertime, they had the windows open, and Stardevant jumped out the window and got away. And so the whole, everybody in the police department, I'm not sure just when this was, I was probably in the early 70s, and just about everybody knew Ron Stardevant, and he was wanted for, amongst other things, jailbreak. And I was working this particular day, I believe it was Munshaw was off. And when you were off, of course, you worked all alone. There was a guy at the Ingham County Jail I wanted to interview. And just before I left to go over to the jail, I got a phone call. And it was a girl, I do not know who she was to this day. She called and says, "Detective Fox, I just want you to know that Ron Stardevant is in the upstairs apartment above the, there was a pet store on South Cedar Street at that time, and upstairs above the pet store was apartments. He is in the apartment above the pet store. When you get to the top of the stairs, there'll be a door on your left and a door on your right, and he's in the room on your left." I really didn't pay much attention to it because I knew Ron Stardevant was too well known to the Lansing Police Department that he would have been in town, and I had had another informant tell me that he had people in Boston, and in fact I had obtained a fugitive warrant and had sent the information to the Boston Police Department that believed to be Stardevant is living with relatives in Boston. I even had an address, but I knew he wasn't in Lansing. So I kind of disregarded this lady's phone call. Got my police car, and I started going to Mason. That time you just drove down Cedar Street to go to Mason. There was no highway. And I came by that pet store, and you could park right alongside Cedar Street. There was parking there, and I thought, hell, I'm going to check it out. So I parked the car, got out, and the door was on the north side of the building, the door to go upstairs to the apartments on the north side of the building, down a little alley. And I walked down that alley, and just as I'm opening up that door, the door busted open, and this girl came running out. And she knew me. I didn't know her, but she knew me. She said, "Hey, Fox, he's up there. He's up there right now." I said, "Who's up there?" She said, "Stardevant. Ain't you over here to get him? He's up there." And she took off, running. I thought, holy mackerel. Well, I knew Stardevant couldn't get out of there. It was the only entrance to the place. I knew he had to come down to that door. So I went back to the police car. Didn't have walkie-talkies in those days. I had to use the police radio. I called in on the police radio. I got Ron Stardevant. I got him cornered where he was at. Need some backup. Going to go get him. So I stood down there on the sidewalk in front of that pet store looking down that alley in case Stardevant would come out of there. Well, several police officers responded, including Jim Hayden. I remember Jim Hayden was one of those who responded to my call for backup, and Detective Koenigsegg. Well, we all went, when they got the backup there, four or five police officers and Detective Koenigsegg, we went upstairs and arrested Stardevant. Took him in and booked him, and now I'm interrogating him. And he says to me, "Well, Fox, do me a favor, give me some kind of a break, do something for me, put in a good word for me." He says, "You know you owe me a favor." And I says, "Stardevant, what the hell favor do I owe you?" And he says, "You can thank me for your life. You can thank me you're alive right now." I said, "What the hell are you talking about?" He says, "Hey, I looked out the window and I saw you standing down at the on the sidewalk, and I knew that you called for backup before you came up to get me." And he says, "I had a .38 revolver and the window was open." And he says, "I pointed it at your head. I knew if I shot you, I could get out of there before help arrived. And I started to squeeze that trigger." And he says, "I changed my mind and I saved your life." I said, "Stardevant, you're so full of BS. You don't think I'm going to believe that?" And he says, "Then do something. Go back to that room where you arrested me, look underneath the pillow on the bed." So I called dispatch and had Detective Koenigsnick, who had been one of the officers, go back and do what Stardevant told me. And I'm sitting there interviewing Stardevant. Pretty soon the door of the interview room knock on it and open up, and there was Koenigsnick, and he had a loaded 38 snub-nosed revolver. He says, "Where'd you get that?" He says, "Underneath the bed where you told me, in the bedroom." So, anyway.
You were a detective for a long time, but eventually you were promoted to sergeant.
Well, in those days, John, I want to interject. I never was a sergeant. Oh. They had detective grade 2, and then when you got promoted to what is now a sergeant, you were detective grade 3, the same as a sergeant, except you didn't call yourself sergeant. You called yourself, you're a detective grade 3. I was a detective grade 2 from 63 to 68, and in 68 I was promoted to detective grade 3, equivalent to a sergeant. And in September of 74, after 11 years as a detective, I was promoted to lieutenant from detective 3 status to lieutenant.
Okay, I never knew that. It's interesting to know that, that there were different grades of detective. I remember when you got promoted. Vaguely, I remember that. Did you get a shift right away?
When I first was promoted to lieutenant, I was the Lansing Police Department's first internal affair investigator. Prior to that position being established, internal investigations were conducted by the detectives. As a detective, I probably did 4 or 5 internal investigations because we did not have an IA. And when I was promoted to lieutenant in September of 74, I was assigned to personnel and training as the IA officer.
That's right.
And then I was there from 74 until 76 for 2 years, and then I was promoted to what was then the patrol captain, who at that time was Cochran, had an executive lieutenant. I don't know if they even have him anymore. But I was the executive lieutenant in patrol from sometime early 76 until January of 77, when I was assigned a platoon. And I think you were on my platoon.
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Help me out with this, because I only remember the rank of detective, and we had some corporals, and then we had sergeants, and then we had a second lieutenant position. Is that second lieutenant position fairly relatively new position?
Yeah, I'm not sure just when it was established, but it was established when Husby became the chief of police. Husby reorganized the police department, and he's the one who, at that time, we had detectives, detective sergeants, and detective lieutenants who actually were street investigators. I worked as a partner to Detective Lieutenant Spike Eady, Detective Lieutenant Oris Montgomery. They were my partners. Well, when Husby became chief, he reorganized and did away with sergeants and lieutenants being street investigators. We were all detectives, and he put the lieutenants in various positions throughout the department, in command positions, and he put the sergeants. I remember I was so happy that I was a detective 2 at that time, because if I would have been a detective 3, which they didn't have, but if I'd have been a detective sergeant, I'd have been gone from my beloved detective bureau, and I'd have been a supervising sergeant. But he did away with sergeants and lieutenants and made everybody a detective. But he instituted the rank of detective grade 3, and I was, about that same time that it was instituted, became a detective grade 3. He also instituted the second lieutenant rank. And that was another rank that I never held. When I took the promotion exam in 1973 for effective, and was promoted, oh, maybe it was 74, I was promoted from detective, and there was no promotional exam in from detective 2 to detective 3. It was just the chief of police decided to promote you, which he did me and several others. But then I took the exam for lieutenant, and you could take both at the newly formed position of second lieutenant and first lieutenant. A sergeant or a detective 3 could take both exams. And I took both exams, and lo and behold, I came in number 1 on both. And to the, without identifying, the man who, the second lieutenant, who was number 2 on the first lieutenant's roster, was convinced that Detective Grade 3 Fox is going to be a second lieutenant, and I'm going to be a first lieutenant. Man, lo and behold, I wasn't a second lieutenant. I went from Detective Grade 3 to first lieutenant. Never was a sergeant, never was a second lieutenant.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I didn't know any of that structure that they had.
During your time with the department, did you sustain any injury on duty type that comes to mind? Whether it was, I don't know if you rode the police bike, because there's sometimes, you know, you go down on that, or some kind of an altercation that caused you some kind of injury?
No, I got bit by a bat one time. But no, I was very fortunate.
Okay.
No, I never received an injury. Oh man, back in those days, if you were sick, the sergeant had to go out to your house and check on you. And one night I had a cold and just didn't feel like going to work. So at 10 o'clock, the shift started at 10 o'clock, I told my wife, before 11 o'clock tonight, Sergeant Beach is going to be out to check on me. So I fixed a little nightstand next to my bed. I put some medications on that nightstand and crawled into bed. And sure enough, he came knocking at the door and came into my bedroom, and I'm laying in bed with this nightstand with different medications on it. And guys, it's unreal what used to go on. And I'm going to also interject here. When the FOP came into being, and I'm going to guess it was in the mid to late 60s, I'm not, yeah. It made my lifestyle a whole lot better, but I'm not sure that I enjoyed the job any better. I mean, I loved it, and back in those days, our soul belonged to the city. But and even though we, now we got started getting pay for overtime, and so many other benefits came along, but I can't say that I ever enjoyed the job more after FOP than I did before.
Well, let's see.
How about technology? You've alluded to, I think, like radios. Anything, well, maybe you want to make a comment on the radios as far as technology of the time that you were in, as far as technology and how it impacted your police work in some respects. Obviously the radio, you mentioned you had to go out to the car, you didn't have a mobile or a handy talkie, walkie talkie, whatever. Any other technologies you can think of that comes to mind?
No, but that was a big one. When we got those handheld radios, I can remember, you know, you walk a beat, and if you had something happen, like my incident with that jewelry store burglary, you had no help. And I didn't even think about blowing my whistle, hoping that another officer would hear it. But you had, the only thing that you had was a call box, and there was never one where you wanted one. And then when you were in a police car, you left that police car to go to a domestic or to a bar fight or to anything. Your only communication was back out there in the street in that police car, because you had nothing.
Let me ask you some questions that from what I remember, way before I was police officer, I used to, I lived in the West Side neighborhood, and we used to go to the White Spot restaurant. There was always cops around
always.
That restaurant.
Always.
Have you got any White Spot stories to tell?
Well, yeah, I know it was a great place. I mean, of course, they, like many places, would give police officers, cops would get free coffee and get a discount on your food. And back in those days, boy, only one police car could be in a place at a time. And sometimes you'd have to have a difficulty getting in that White Spot. And I don't really have any stories to tell about it, but it was a very popular place. It was a 24-hour restaurant, which were few in those days, that and the coffee shop on Large Street. The Trio restaurants were all, they were all 24 hours, or three of them. That's why they call them the Trio. Pennsylvania, Michigan, Washington, and Lenawee. And then out on South Cedar Street, originally at Mount Hope and Cedar, and then it moved further on down Cedar where House of Ing is now. One time, Fred Wilkins and I were in the back room of the Trio having a cup of coffee, the one on Washington, across the street from the bus station. We were having a cup of coffee back there with the cook, and pretty soon the waitress came running back there. She'd just been robbed. We were in the back with the cook having a cup of coffee, and somebody came in the front of the store and pulled an armed robbery and got away. We didn't know it, you know. But and then all in those days, I'm sure you guys remember hats on your head. Oh, you had to have a hat on. Now, I'll never forget the day that John Jones and I went into the Trio on South Cedar Street, went into the back, and left our caps in the car, had a cup of coffee, and Rainwater came by and saw our caps in the car. So he knew we didn't have them on. And he sat there waiting for us. And when we came walking out, you know, Rainwater, did you guys serve under Rainwater?
I did.
You know, I mean, he was a trip.
Oh.
And we came walking out, and Rainwater got out of his car, and did he chew us out for leaving our caps in the car like at 3 o'clock in the morning to go into the back door of a restaurant to have a cup of coffee. Yeah, that was a big issue then, caps on your head.
It lasted a long time.
I'd like to tell another story that I think is of interest. I was a detective, and there was a the Lansing Police Department, Lieutenant Griffin called me in the office one day, and he had a mug shot of a Cleveland Police Department and a certified copy of a warrant for murder. And he says there was an apartment house at that time on West Lenawee Street. I believe it was called the Lenawee Apartments. You guys might remember it. Okay. So Griffin called me in, give me a photograph, a mugshot of this guy who was wanted for murder, and a certified copy of the warrant. And Griff says so calmly, you know, like, Dick, sometime in your travels, swing by the Lenawee Street Apartments and see if you can arrest this guy. And he gave me the mug and the certified copy of the warrant. Well, I had an informant who lived in that building. Her name was May Tate. And you remember
that
May?
Name?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I went over and contacted May Tate, and I said to her, showed her a picture of the mug. Said, do you recognize this guy at all? Says, yeah. Right over there, he pointed across the hall. He lives with Kathy Davis. He and Kathy are living in that apartment right there. And I said, do you know if he's there? He says, no, I know he's not, because I saw him and Kathy leave about an hour ago, and they're not there. I gave May my card and says, May, call me the next time he's there. I wrote my home phone number on that card. Says, call me, no matter when it is, the time of the day, when it is, call me. Because he's wanted for murder in Cleveland. So May, okay. Well, one week or so later, Griffin called me in the office and says, hey, Fox, did you ever make a reach for this guy that's wanted in Cleveland? And I says, no, I haven't. Because if you make a reach for somebody like that and you miss him, they're gone. You ain't, he's not only gone from Lenaway Apartments, he's gone from Lansing. Says, so once you make a reach for him, you got to get him. Griff says, well, that makes sense. Says, I got an informant who's going to call me when she knows he's there. Several days later, I'm in the office at 8 o'clock in the morning getting ready to go to work, and the phone rang, and it's May Tate. Fox, he's there. He's there right now. I said, thank you, May. I walked out into the bay, and Ron Floyd was there. He says, Ron, you got a few minutes? I'm going to go over and arrest a guy, and I want some backup. He says, sure. So Ron and I drove over there, just the two of us. I showed Ron the mug and the warrant, and he's wanted for murder in Cleveland. When we got there, the ground floor, you could go out a window into the yard. I mean, the ground floor was at yard level, and I knew there were windows, and I saw it. Ron, you stand right there in case he goes out that window. That's where he's going to go, and I'll go in. So I go in, I knock at the door, and Davis says, who's there? And I says, Fuller Brush. She opened the door, and she saw me, and she knew me. She slammed that door. My foot hurt for weeks because I stuck my foot in it, had my gun drawn. I stepped in, and I says, Kathy, I know Joe is here. Where's he at? I don't know what you're talking about. Well, just happened to open up a closet door, and it was dark in there, and I reached in, and I felt this guy in there, and I jerked him out, slammed him to the floor, put the handcuffs on him, walked out, and yelled over to Floyd, got him, Ron. Guys, not being critical of what I did, and not being critical of what the police department would have done, but you know what the police department would do today if they went over to the Lenaway Street Apartments to arrest a man wanted for murder? Hell, they'd evacuate not only the building, they'd evacuate the whole street, and they'd call in the START team, and they'd call in everybody that was available, and they'd make a big deal of it. Back in those days, you just went in and did the job. Now, I'm not criticizing the police department. Maybe I should be criticized, but that's the way it was.
Very good. Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us some captain stories. You were a captain a long time.
I was a captain so long that people outside the police department thought my first name was Captain. I was promoted to captain in 1978 and retired in 1995. I know that my 42 years in the police department is the longest serving of any. At least I lay claim to that, and if somebody wants to prove I'm wrong, I'll listen to them. But I believe I'm the oldest serving member, the longest serving member, and I might be the longest serving captain. I was a captain from 78 till I retired in 95, and I was a captain of personnel and training, then Central Records. I enjoyed both P&T and Central Records. But my last 10 years, I was back home in my love of the detectives, and I was a captain of the detectives, and it was tough. When my time came to retire, I knew it was time to go. But I didn't feel great about retiring. In fact, I remember the article in the paper, State Journal, about my retirement. And it was written on the day I retired, and says, at about noon today, Captain Fox will be leaving the Lansing Police Department. He's retiring. But he's not going to go out on cartwheels. He's going to sneak out the back door. And I was quoted then as saying, my hero was General Douglas MacArthur. And MacArthur said, old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And I just kind of wanted to fade away. I loved that place. Oh, I also remember, this was quoted in the paper, I loved my job, and I was good at it, and I did a good job as a 42-year police officer. But I owe the city of Lansing much more than she owes me.
Now, being a captain for all those years, you went to a lot of staff meetings. And as a lower-ranking officer, we always wondered what went on. Do you have any staff meeting stories you can tell us?
Well, the first time that I went to staff meetings, O'Toole was the chief. And if anybody did the least little goof up, he had a little coin container on it. He'd find you a quarter. I never would go to staff without a pocket full of quarters. Then after he left and Gleason became chief, I remember the first staff meeting that Gleason held, and he said, "No more quarters. You guys are not going to be fined." You know. So, also, I know under O'Toole, those staff meetings used to take about 3 hours. You'd go down there at 8:30 in the morning. You were lucky to get out of there for lunch. Everybody would sit around and try to outdo the next guy. And every day, 5 days a week, we'd have staff meetings. And then after Gleason became chief, he cut them down to 3 days a week. And they were much shorter, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And then when Ree Snyder became chief, they went to one, staff meetings were 1 day a week. But when I first started going, every morning you'd, and you better have something to offer. I used to work harder as a captain getting ready to make my presentation at staff than I did at anything else, because you better not just go down there when it came your turn to talk. And without mentioning some of the captains over the years, man, some of those guys, I used to say, "Will you shut up?"
You mentioned a piece on your retirement, and someone gave me a little piece of information that you had your, I think, a grandson in the car, and you were singing in the car, and I think Channel 1 got locked open. Tell us a little bit about that?
It was great. I had three grandkids. I was babysitting them for, I don't know if I was babysitting, I had three grandkids over the house, and that would have been just maybe 6 weeks or shortly before my retirement. And so in 95, these kids would have been 6 and maybe 2 and 4 or something like that. And I was giving them a ride home in the police car. And somehow or another, that radio, which I don't think is possible anymore, in those days they used to get stuck on sometimes. Remember that? They would, you know. And we're driving home, and we got singing. Oh, I got the recording at home. Dispatch made a recording of it. It's hilarious. I've been working on the railroad, and I believe it was MSU fight. We were all singing. You know, these kids and I were singing, and it was going out over the radio. And when I got home, walked into the house, my wife says, "You're supposed to call the police department right away." I says, "What happened?" She says, "Did you have your radio stuck on?" I called in and they told me about it. Well, it turns out that this turned out to be one of my real compliments that happened to Dick Fox. The next day, the chief called me in, Chief Jerry Bowles. And he called me in and he says, "Dick, that incident happened last night with that sing-along." He says, "That was all good, clean fun." But he says, "I'm telling you, that could have been nasty. That whole conversation was listened to by everybody who's got a police radio and a police scanner. That could have been nasty." I says, "How could that have been nasty, Chief?" He says, "You could have said something really bad, really detrimental." I says, "Chief, no way. Dick Fox, radio on or off, is never going to say anything bad or detrimental." And Bowles looked at me and says, "You know, Dick, you're right, you wouldn't." So that was kind of the end of quite a story. I got a lot of kidding over it, but nobody was really, you know, overcritical of it. But I still have the recording.
How about some of the major things that happened while you were there? The big cases or the big incidents or the big disasters that happened over time. You have any stories with regard to those? And I'm saying things like maybe the flood or the fire at the
Turner Street
Cast building.
Oh, Cass Billy.
Oh, yeah, Turner Street. Something like that.
Yeah, I remember the fire at the Cass Building. It was before my time. In fact, I was home on furlough when that Cass Building fire was, and I remember going down and watching it burn, but I was not on the police department. And we had the race riots in those days and the student revolts. I didn't really play a role in it, as I said earlier, but I was aware of it. No, I can't think of anything that would really be of interest that happened all those years.
The floods, do you remember those?
I remember them well. Mid-70s? Yeah, sure do. I remember the big flood would have been in 1975.
I think that's right, yeah.
And it was a flood, but the east side of Lansing was flooded. I mean, it was bad, all the way from River Street all the way out to the city limits. Mm-hmm. But I didn't play a role in it except drove out and observed it.
Do you have anything to do with the Mack Donnelly shooting?
No, I was a platoon lieutenant when that happened, and I know that you would have been on my platoon. We were either off duty, I don't think we were the platoon on duty at that time.
No, we weren't on days.
No, I just remember it was a terrible tragedy. I was in Washington, D.C., last week and went to the police officer's memorial, and Donnelly's name is on there. Several Lansing police officers are on there. Yeah. But Donnelly, that was a terrible thing. Yeah.
Remember the Murnihan case?
Oh, remember it well. I was on vacation. We were going to go to Petoskey, which is my wife's home, and we were out of the motel in that time on... We went out to a motel called Horns Motel. It was on South Cedar Street. It's not Horns anymore. We'd go out there and rent a room for the day and use the swimming pool. We had everything packed. We were going to go to Petoskey the next day. And we were enjoying the day at the swimming pool when I learned of the Murnihan kidnapping. Not murder. She wasn't murdered yet. The kidnapping. So whether stupid or not, I called into the police department and got Lieutenant Griffin and asked him if I'm ready to go to Petoskey. The bags are packed. The wife and kids are anxious to go. He says, but I do want you to know if you need me, I'm here. He says, get in here. So I went in, and for about 3 days, they set up a tip center. I don't know if this police department still does that or not. The tip center where all Tucker was in charge of the tip center. He was, I believe, a lieutenant at the time. He ended up retiring as deputy chief or assistant. Anyway, they had this tip center where tips would come in, and because they had a composite drawing of the guy who did it, so that created a lot of tips. And I'm going to believe the reason I wasn't assigned as the chief investigator of the case because I'm on vacation. I probably would have been, but Hibbard and Adams were the chief investigators. And I was called in and assigned to the tip center, just running out tips. So for 3 days, running out tips of people who looked like the composite drawing, this looks like this guy, I ran all over Metro Lansing checking on. And after about 3 days, my wife and kids are gnawing at the bit to go up to Petoskey. So I went into Lieutenant Griffin. I says, if I was really doing any good, but I'm just running out these tips, and they're coming in faster than you can keep up with them, and I technically am on vacation. Before I could complete the sentence, he said, get your ass out of here and go on up and enjoy your vacation. So that was my only extent with the Murnihan, but it was probably the biggest crime that I remember. One time there was a little grocery store on Brook Street. The guy's name was Charlie Johnson, and at the time, Lieutenant Griffin lived in the neighborhood, and he was my boss. Some guys went in there and murdered and robbed the Brook Street grocery, Charlie Johnson. And I was assigned the case. Munshaw and I, and Griffin called us in and said, I don't know what you guys have got on your calendar, but he says, clear it. If you got something that has to be done, give it to me and I'll reassign it. But I want you guys, I'm going to assign you that Johnson murder case, and I'm not going to bother you with any other, because in those days you get a murder case, if you didn't solve it within 3 days, you were getting other cases. You couldn't spend. He says, I'm not going to bother you guys until you either come in here and tell me you've made an arrest on the Johnson murder, or you're going to come in here and tell me there's nothing else you can do. It's you can't solve it. But until that happens, so after about 3 days of, again, running down leads and running down tips and getting, you know, we were pretty much at a dead end. And I said to Munshaw, now Tom's a great guy, I hope he isn't going to mind what I'm going to say, says, Tom, I don't know what else to do. We've ran down, I mean, we went to Flint because we had a description of a car. It was a red Pontiac with the left front fender smashed in, and Flint police had a car matching that description. Jackson, we went to Jackson. We were just running tips out, you know, and we all we knew was these three guys. One stayed in the car, and two guys were black. They were all three black guys, and it's all we knew at this time. Tom, I guess, you know, I don't know what else to do. We've run out of leads. I don't know what else to do. I guess we got to go in and tell Griffin. And old Tom says, Dick, let's milk this for a couple days. Well, we didn't have to because it was two guys came into the detective bureau. They were state workers, and they were walking across the street at noon, Pine Street, on their way downtown to get a lunch, and they saw this red Pontiac with a fender dented in, speeding, headed southbound on Pine Street, and they ran the red light. They were in a hurry to go, and now the one guy says, and now we understand that you're looking for a car that fits that description in an armed robbery that occurred just minutes before. And we know, there were three blacks in the car, we know that was the car. And it turned into a driveway in the next block. Well, now we had something. Well, we ended up, after a lengthy investigation, we ended up getting the, in fact, the car belonged to a, I still see him every once in a while, his name was Tony Sedino. That's who the car belonged to, because we found the car. It was parked at 511 South Pine. But it was Tony Sedino. Well, we knew, we had a witness. The lady sat on the porch across the street, and she saw three blacks pull up. The two got out and went into the grocery store, and one stayed in the car. So we knew there were blacks. Well, Sedino was a Mexican. So, well, Sedino, all he knew, he lived in that house with some blacks, and he says, and mine is the only car. Says, I leave the keys on the TV, and it's sort of, it's my car, but it's a community car. Anybody can use it. On that particular day and time, it would have been February the 12th of 1970. Says, I have no idea who took that car. Well, we did an investigation. In fact, we found this lady who lived across the street from Pine Street, who came forward that they had planned the robbery in her house. We wired her and we got a recording, and she told us exactly who did what, but she was not going to be a witness. We had to build, now we knew who did it, but we had to build a case without her involvement. Well, we got Tony Sedino, and we brought Tony Sedino in. We had a fake warrant. We'd gone over to the prosecutor's office, and on the desk was warrants. And we took one of those blank warrants, and we typed it up, charging Sedino with murder. We picked Sedino up. He worked at Fisher Body and arrested him for murder, brought him into the police station, showed him the warrant, and he couldn't talk quick enough. Oh, no, you got the wrong man. And he told us exactly who did what. He didn't know who had stayed in the car. He didn't know who went into the store. But he knew Chapel, Hundley, and Harris had were the three involved. Well, anyway, we ended up finding out that Harris, when they pulled up to that store, he saw that lady in the porch across the street. He says, "Hey guys, we gotta abort." He says, "See that lady? She's got us spotted. She's got us eyeballed. We can't go rob this place now." So he stayed in the car, and the other two, Chapel and Hunley, went in and robbed and murdered the guy. Why they shot him is that Chapel bought a bag of potato chips. The guy opened up the cash register. Chapel brought the shotgun out from underneath his coat. The guy slammed the door shut, and Chapel thought that bang was a gunshot. He thought he was shooting at me, so he shot him dead. However, the guy who had stayed in the car, he had nothing to do with it. He went there to rob the place, but when he saw the lady, he backed off. So we ended up using him as a material witness and got the other two, convicted them for murder.
Speaking of that, did you work the Fabiano murder where he was a store owner?
I know. He had the store on Willow Street. I knew him. I'm not sure where I was at. I'm not sure I was in the detectives. But I remember when he got, I knew him as, but I did not work that case. No.
As far as I know, that was never solved.
No, it was never solved. No.
Yeah, did you work or have anything to do with the investigation when my aunt was killed downtown?
Refresh my memory.
My aunt was owned Kelly Temporary Services.
I remember that.
And
yes,
her office
yeah.
was in the back of the
yes, yeah.
Michigan Theater.
Yes, I remember that. No, I did not. I did not work that, but I do recall it. Yes, I do. Yeah.
That was a pretty big case.
Yeah, it sure was. What year was that?
That was about in 1980.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's like an 80, 81, something.
Yeah. See, I would have been a captain. But I remember it well.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
How about any weather related stories? Any big snowstorms?
Oh, man, the snowstorm of 67. Mm-hmm. I was working, detectives used to work nights, and I was working nights, Lieutenant Edie and I, and it started to snow about the time we went to work at 8 o'clock at night, and by 4 o'clock in the morning, when we got off duty, it was coming down like I've never seen anything like it. I think we had 25 inches. I mean, it was really snowing. Well, we were able to get home. And the next night, I didn't know how I was going to get to work. Well, they send an army truck out to my house to get me to go to work that night. That was we had police officers plowing snow. If you can believe that. Were you guys on the police?
I was, yeah. And I remember we got some of those 6x's out of Rio.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that was our mode of transportation because
yeah.
our cars couldn't get anywhere.
Yeah, right.
right.
Yeah.
And we were primarily getting like doctors, nurses to
yeah.
the hospitals
yeah.
and things of that nature.
Yeah.
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 There wasn't snowmobiles back then.
I guess.
Well, there's a couple around out there, but that wasn't as prominent
yeah.
like you see today.
I don't know how much more you want me to rattle on here, but I got another case that I think is of interest.
Well, we got about 10 minutes until our hour and a half is up. So.
Okay. Well, there was a robbery assault that occurred at that time. It was Keeps Market on Aurelius Road, and I really don't remember what the what it is now, but it was Keeps Market then. And there was a man went in there from Fisher Body and cashed his check. And Oscar Figueres was in there and saw him cash his check. So Oscar bought a bottle of beer. Went outside and he waited for this guy. And the guy came out. His car was parked in the parking lot. Oscar hit him over the head with the beer bottle. He knew he had just cashed his check and he had $100 or so in his billfold, and Oscar took it, and I was assigned the case, and I took a investigation. I found out it was Oscar Figueres, and I got a warrant. Then the guy, he hit him over the head and knocked him down. Then Figueres goes and gets in his car, and the guy came to and got up and tried to stop, and Figueres tried to run him over with the car. So I got a warrant for armed robbery, assault with intent to commit murder. Now Figueres, I couldn't find him. So put the warrant in lien and went about my business. And one day, I know I was working with Munshaw at the time, but in those days, detectives, you worked partners, but one would be off Saturday, Sunday, and the other Sunday and Monday. Well, Munshaw had worked Saturday, so I come in Monday morning and I'm all alone. And Monday you were at half strength because half the guys were off. So I came in Monday morning, and Groke was the captain. And Groke said, Fox, they got Figueres in jail in Toledo. Go get him. And I remember saying, Captain, you're not going to send me to Toledo to get Figueres all alone. He's wanted for armed robbery and attempted murder. And I remember going, Fox, you know it's Monday morning, and we're short-staffed on Mondays. Go get him. You got handcuffs. Handcuff his hands behind his back. I mean, we didn't even have the cages in the cars, you know. Says, handcuff him behind his back and go get him. He's just a punk. So I drove to Toledo, pulled up right in front of the Toledo police station. One police station in the city of Toledo. No precincts. I drove up in front of the police station in Toledo, Ohio. I went in, identified myself, and says, I'm here to get Oscar Figueres. And they called somebody, and pretty soon the elevator opened. This great, big, gruff-looking detective, and he had Figueres with him. I knew Figueres. He had Figueres with him. And he had Figueres was cuffed in front, and I knew I was going to have to cuff him behind, but that's not the story. The story is, he said to me, here he is. And I says, well, I got to have the waiver. He signed a waiver of extradition. And this detective, hell no, he wouldn't sign nothing. He wouldn't sign it. I said, I can't take him back to Michigan if he didn't sign a waiver. I got to go back and formally extradite him. I got to get a governor's warrant. And this detective looked at me like, what kind of rinky-dink outfit are you with? He says to me, he didn't say that. He looked at me like, says, where are you parked? I says, right out in front. Says, go get in your car. Okay, well, what's he going to do? Well, about 5 minutes later, I'm sitting there, and he came pulling up in his car. He's driving, Figueres is sitting in the back, and he is motioning me. I followed him to Welcome to Michigan. He pulled over to the curb. I pulled in behind him. He gets out. He comes up to me, and he says, he took his cuffs off of Figueres. He says, you got your cuffs? And I pulled him out. And I said, put him, cuff him behind his back. So he cuffed him behind his back, and I put him in the car and drove back home. And I never said a word, didn't tell anybody. But we get ready to go to trial. He pled not guilty to the charges. We're sitting in that little room across from the courthouse, Ray Scadeller and I, and we're getting ready to, you know how you do just before you go to court. And I told Ray, he got mad. Ray Scadeller got so mad at Dick Fox, he was mad. I said, well, Ray, what did I do wrong? He says, what did you do wrong? You kidnapped him. For gosh sakes, you can't do that stuff. I said, I didn't do nothing. I took control of him in Michigan. Oh, that's, you know. I said, what's going to happen? I said, I'll tell you what's going to happen. We're going to go in that courtroom in front of that judge. And a judge is going to order you to take him back to Toledo and do this right. About that time, the bailiff knocked and ordered, we're ready to go. So we walked into that courtroom. That court case lasted 3 or 4 days, a jury trial. They convicted Figueres of armed robbery and assault with intent to commit murder. And it never surfaced. Never surfaced as to how I kidnapped him. Apparently, Figueres didn't know. He must have not thought it was wrong because it never surfaced.
I'll be back. Yeah. Oh my word, that is a good one there. Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Our hour and a half is almost exactly up, and so let's just we'll just end the interview right now. And before we do, I want to thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
Yes.
For us, especially, to listen to these stories. And your contribution is much appreciated by the association as we progress through this this project.
Well, you're certainly welcome, both John and it's always been Jim.
That's fine. That's my name.
You guys, I feel honored to have been selected to do this interview. And I'm glad you're preserving the history of the Lansing Police Department. The Lansing Police Department means an awful lot to me, and I want to commend and thank you guys not only for this interview, but for everything you're doing for the Lansing Police Historical Commission.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you can think of anything in the future, please call upon us to, you know, expand on or help us do this better. And in fact, if you feel up to it and you wanted to do an additional storytelling interview, we're all ears and we'll be all recorders or whatever and be glad to set it up and do it, sir. You just name the, you know, just give us enough time to kind of put it together, so to speak, and get a date and time together for that purpose.
One thing we discuss a possibility of doing, and you might give this some thought, is, for instance, bringing in, like, an interview with you and Tom Munshaw to talk about those cases that you worked, you know, just strictly detective cases that the two of you worked together. That way you could kind of work off of each other's thoughts and everything. And but we haven't done one of those. We were going to, the mainstay of this is just individual interviews, but I think at some point those kind of things would be really interesting. So if you run across Tom or something, you might mention it, and if he's willing to do that, we could do the same thing. That'd be pretty neat.
Yeah, I agree.
Are we off?
No.
Okay, we're
off now.